Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we begin with a segment on why history matters in the present. We'll be discussing the making of the modern world, the 20th century world, 1914 to the present, and the state of modernity. We're joined by Professor John Corbally, author of a book of the same name. Later in the program, we'll get an update from Chase Palmieri, CEO of Predator. We'll learn more about the state of crowd-contested media. Join us for an action-packed hour of the Project Censored Show. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of today's program, we're going to be looking, well, at the making of the modern world. That's the title of a series of history texts out from Bloomsbury Books. We're going to be joined today by Dr. John Corbally. Dr. John Corbally is professor of history at Diablo Valley College, where he teaches world history, critical thinking, and European history. He taught history and humanities courses at Stanford for 5 years, and British, Irish, European, and world history at UC Berkeley, UC Davis, and Mills College, among others. On today's program, we're going to talk about this series of books where John Corbally is one of the authors. He is, of course, principal author on The 20th Century World, 1914 to the Present, on the State of Modernity. This series of books, this is, again, coming from someone who not only is a scholar of modern history, but also someone that's long taught it. And this is a series of textbooks that really is designed for the classroom. And so we're going to talk to Dr. Corbally today about the text. We're going to talk about historiography. We're going to talk about why history matters in the present, a whole host of things. But just quickly, to let you know about the 20th century world, the book we're discussing now, 1914 to the present, it introduces students to 5 distinct historical themes in 20th century history: politics, economics, thought, technology, and environment. Each of the themes is set in a social-cultural history framework that emphasizes the commonalities and differences in human experiences throughout the last century. So, John Corbally, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, Mickey. It's nice to be here.
I'm glad that we finally have you on the air. We've been talking about it for a long time. You've been working on this series of books. It's going to be a trilogy. So what are all of the titles?
This is the 20th century version that you just described. That's my volume. It's 1914 to the present. Trevor Getz of San Francisco State, a very well-known African historian, he published also 2 years ago the long 19th century Crucible of Modernity, which covers the period 1750 to 1914. So I do the 20th century. He did the 18th and 19th. And the third volume is coming out next year, which is Casey Sullivan and myself with Trevor's help, and that's 1450 to 1750, the early modern world, and that is Seeds of Modernity. So the 3-part series is about modernity and a world historical approach, generally trying to look at history with a new lens, through the lens of the common person, the slave, the peasant, the villager, rather than elites, which is typically the case.
So it sounds like you're certainly doing more of a people's approach or a people's history through a global perspective.
It's definitely influenced by Howard Zinn, and as much as we can find primary sources to understand world history through the common perspective, we try to look at it just as much as we can from the lens of average people. You can't ignore elites, of course, they shape history, but just taking that approach from looking at it from below is what makes it different, and also the thematic approach, which you've hinted at there, which I can talk more about too.
And of course, right in the beginning, you say, well, what is this book? And you talk about how the book is laid out, and again, you know, this is a part of the book often that students often ignore. Some of the introductory materials, right. The sort of why this book, 5 threads, for example. Right. I mentioned that just briefly, but why don't you talk to us a little bit about this wild 100 years, as you put it in the intro, and talk about these 5 threads as you see them pedagogically.
We recognize students don't always do the reading. We recognize some students don't like history. So Trevor and I thought a few years ago, why don't we try a different approach whereby, in this case, with the 20th century, in my volume, the first chapter goes through the political history of the century, and most people have a sense of that, the politics, the wars, kings and generals. That's the traditional approach to history. So a student has read 100 years of history in the first chapter, in the first week or two. Then we do the whole century again, but this time with an economic perspective, looking at capitalism, communism, agriculture, land tenure. So you've gone through the century twice in the first two chapters, and then we go through it a third time looking at the technological history of the century, so the technology from cars and bikes to nuclear bombs. And then we go through it a fourth time in chapter four, which is the religious and philosophical approach to ideas through the century. And lastly, crucially, we end up with the environmental history. So the fifth chapter is your fifth run through the century, looking at it from an environmental standpoint, which is diseases and populations, and it's taken out the anthropocentric lens, so to speak. Humans are taken out of it somewhat and looking at the land and abuses of the land, from dams to diseases.
Definitely a more fascinating approach, I think. Same periods, right. But you're having a different lens, different focal points. And for folks out there that don't teach history or aren't history professors, and even for some who don't take many of those courses, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of folks don't realize how history is taught. Some people have the high school approach where it's the one damn thing after another. This happened and that happened and then this and then that and then the winner and the loser and the so forth. This is very different because it's back and forth and to and fro and it ebbs and cycles. So talk about what's beneficial about that from the teaching standpoint as well as the student that's absorbing it. And not just taking it in, but being encouraged. The way that you've written this is very encouraging for people to think and apply the historical matters to the present.
Yeah, well, all three volumes, we talked a lot about making it readable. Most of us who teach history love history and always have done. But I hated history at school as a kid. It was boring to me. It was the Tudors and the Stuarts, and it bored the socks off me as well. So I'm acutely conscious of bored students, and I want to grab them. When we started writing these volumes, Trevor Goetz and I, we really wanted to make sure we weren't ideological. We're both liberal. We both live in the Bay Area. But we wanted to make this work readable to all students, to conservative, centrist, rich, poor, male, female, you name it. So I hope that it comes across as readable to all people, but it's not ideological. It tells the history from a global perspective. Students struggle with the reading more and more, so we figured going through the 20th century in this case, or the 18th century in Trevor's volume, going through the centuries five times, you're learning a similar enough history, but from five perspectives. So you're still learning the basic outline of the centuries that you're studying about.
And of course, you're also talking about some of the major conflicts of the 20th century eras. And not just top-down with the wars, but you're talking about 20th century thought. You're talking about ideological differences.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not that you can talk about World War I and World War II without thinking about generals and politicians and kings, but you can focus instead on the major battles, but focus on the experience of the common man and the families at home, their wives, daughters, and mothers. That's the subtle tweaking as we're looking at the same events, capitalism, depression, World War I, World War II. You can't ignore that, Cold War, but from the perspective of common people. The Cold War, we look at it from the perspective of the Third World, or, unforgivably to some people, from the perspective of Stalin and the Russians. They have a view of the Cold War too.
Which is markedly different than the top-down U.S. exceptionalist view.
Absolutely, and also it's not to befriend Stalin, who was a megalomaniac, but it's to understand that he did spend the 1930s warning us about Hitler. That's fair and true.
It is. You present these different perspectives and sides, and you're giving the reader the opportunity to understand viewpoints they either aren't familiar with at all, or they've been somehow subtly or not so subtly taught are wrong or are other in some way.
Yeah, I think that the best way to put it is we try to take a social approach and an environmental approach. Social approach meaning what was it like for most people to live through these events, as much as we can deduce that. And environmentally, always being conscious of every act as an environmental act. When we're building dams to build Egypt as a state in the 1950s, we're exploiting the environment, and we've got this duality throughout the series of exploitation. To exploit is to use efficiently, whether it's humans or raw materials or animals, but to exploit is also to exploit negatively and oppress. And so there's this kind of dialectic approach to that word throughout. It's a social justice and environmental justice approach, but without casting aspersions on any social groups or blaming any nation, America, Russia, China, or whatnot.
You mentioned the exploitation, for example, of so-called third world countries in the Cold War. Former CIA station chief John Stockwell actually called the Cold War a third world war, meaning that it was a war on the third world, and it was also technically like World War III, the third world war. Right. Granted, that's not something that you see coming from the White House and people screaming from the State Department, but this is somebody that was CIA whistleblower basically calling it what it is. You talk about the Cold War and decolonization, too. So how do you address that kind of a topic?
The main thing we do is we stick to the mainstream narrative that's the United States and the Soviet Union fighting each other ideologically. It's a Cold War. But as you well know, it's actually a very hot war around most of the world. So that's what we've done is we focus on the main events briefly, but then we spend most of the period talking about the effects in Angola or Afghanistan or elsewhere. It's looking at the Cold War from the Third World's perspective in that case.
We're speaking with Professor John Corbally. He's a historian at Diablo Valley College. John, you did your PhD at UC Davis, right?
My master's was in world history. My PhD was in European history with a focus on imperialism and racism.
That definitely comes out in the text, right? And of course, you can't write a history of the 20th century without talking about those issues.
Right. A good way to look at it is the Cold War is seen as a Cold War, a lot of saber-rattling, yelling at each other from podiums. That's the case for the Soviet Union and the US, for the West at large. It's not for the rest of the world, as you know. Another parallel for the 19th century version is it's known as a century of peace for Europeans, right, since the Congress of Vienna. Likewise, it's the westward expansion for happy white Americans. Things are great here, too, in the 19th century. It's not a huge leap to point out that the 19th century is plenty of violence around the world, once you look at it from a world historical approach, the third world, undeveloped regions of the world. It's not taking the lens away from Western history, because you can't ignore that in the last 200, 300 years. But it's actually looking at it from the perspective of somebody in Senegal or even Ireland or Native Americans or...
So, John Corbley, given that this is certainly your area of expertise, what can you tell us about the shift away from European to world history interpretively? That seems to be a growing trend. And of course, you developed the world history courses for us at Diablo Valley College. And so would you say then that's definitely a direction that we're moving in the history realm?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd say two things to that. One is that I've always been scarred by one day when I was teaching at Stanford and a very well-to-do, articulate, intelligent Wolf of Wall Street type student said to me, why does world history matter? And I said, I think if we could teach world history to everybody, we could have world peace. And I was being slightly sardonic with that, but it's better than what we have now, which is very little historical knowledge. So I was pointing out how important I thought world history was, and he kind of brushed it away as it's irrelevant. And I remember that vividly, because it is, to me, one of the most important fields you can teach, and that's why I focus on it. At the same time, as you know, world history has only been taught for the last 20, 30 years in Western colleges. We typically taught Western civilization, and I still teach that at DVC, but I teach it online. Western civilization focused on that Eurocentric kind of Anglo-American Judeo-Christian story, and the history of Western civilization is very important. A lot has happened that matters. Many people that I get my degrees with think we shouldn't teach that anymore. Now, I happen to disagree. I think we should teach both, which is why I teach both at DVC, Western Civ and World History. But having said that, going forward, world history to me is much more inclusive and broader, and as much as we can know the past, more representative of the past from a world historical perspective.
If listeners are curious about it, you did hear Dr. Corbley just say that he teaches some of these sections online. This show airs from Hawaii to New England, although you'd have to pay out-of-state fees and such, right? But it's accessible to people. It's dvc.edu. You can find John Corbley there. You can look at the course titles and so on. The book we're talking about right now, The 20th Century World, 1914 to the Present, it's on the state of modernity, and this is part of a series out on Bloomberry Publishing, bloomberry.com. We're speaking with Professor John Corbley, professor of history at Diablo Valley College, and again, this is his recent book. One of three, the third is coming out, The Seeds of Modernity, going back to the 1450s, right? From 1450 to about 1750.
That's right.
So at any rate, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm speaking with John Corbley. We're speaking about why history matters. After this brief musical break, we're going to continue our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are looking at world history. We're joined by Professor of History, John Corbley. He teaches at Diablo Valley College. We're talking about John Corbley's latest book, The Making of the Modern World, The 20th Century World, 1914 to the Present, State of Modernity. So this is basically the last 100 years.
And where I hope it stands out is that it's looking at the 20th century, which is so familiar to so many people. But it's looking at the history of the 20th century from a world historical perspective. That's a lot to squeeze into a small number of chapters, and you're necessarily speaking at a superficially high level. But I wanted to look at it from a world historical perspective instead of an Anglo-American. We won both wars, we're the good guys, there are no bad guys. There are plenty of people that are excluded from these histories, and we wanted to bring in the history of two groups, as I mentioned earlier, the Third World, but also peasants, soldiers, workers, mothers in the West. The people that made the decisions that led to these wars were typically small cliques of elites working in their own interests. So as I often say to my students, I don't want you to talk about the Germans or the Japanese and blame all those people. Typically, it was German elites or Japanese militarists who made decisions that led to these events. And the same goes for the West. Most soldiers, when World War I is coming, English, French, or American, they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what's coming. They're pawns. So again, to look at it from the perspective of the common person and from the Third World at large, that was where we hoped.
John Corbally, this is a 300-page textbook. It's not every day that we talk about history textbooks. And there's a great thing that I'm a big fan of. You have these interludes between each of the five sections. And of course, the first one caught my eye immediately on politics because the interlude is on propaganda. And that's something we talk about here a lot at the Project Censored Show. Tell us about what these interludes are for, what they do. I mean, you got these great World War I propaganda posters, and you jump all the way through Afghanistan and Iraq after 9/11. So tell us about that.
That's actually very important because we figured even though we're writing a more brief, digestible history, some students may still not do the reading. So what we wanted to do is have four sections, four interludes in between the five chapters, which one is political, again, one is economic, one is technological, and one is religious philosophical. They're the four interludes. Now, what we wanted to do in the whole series is make these two or three pages long, and they essentially serve to answer the question every student asks, which is, why do I care about this? Mm-hmm. When you're having 30 pages of reading on the political history of the 20th century, some students are reading it, but they don't understand why it matters, and that's fair enough. So these interludes are very straight to the point. Propaganda, power, politics, what is it? How was it in 1900? How is it today? And as you well know, it's not that different in many ways. So I make the very clear point that there was certainly propaganda on the side of the Germans, but there was propaganda on the side of the Allies too in World War I. Propaganda is what you get everywhere. It's this notion that we're all indoctrinated. We know communists and fascists were indoctrinated, and they were, but we're indoctrinated. It's not equal, it's not the same, but there's indoctrination through education.
In particular, Germany and the Soviets were riffing off of Edward Bernays. I mean, they were literally riffing off the methodologies that came from Sigmund Freud's nephew.
Right.
And he wrote a book in 1928 literally called Propaganda. Right.
There's a wonderful documentary on Bernays on YouTube, actually.
Yeah. Century of Self.
Yeah. It talks about how consumerism is just so constructed and was enforced as an ideology. So to compare that to communism is your choice, but indoctrination is a process in all modern nation states. And that's what that interlude is talking about. And that's what we do with the other sections too. Capitalism, in the second interlude, it talks about economics and inequality and asks the rather difficult question of, should we expect equality? Is inequality unjust? Capitalism is not democracy and vice versa.
So again, a lot of big ideas that you're tackling in the book here, John Corbally. We'd of course be remiss if we didn't mention nationalism and the major role that that plays in the 20th century in particular. And again, we were speaking before and you said, how blinkered understanding of history through a nationalist or identity politics lens leads to slivered ideological simplicity on both the left and the right. What does that mean?
I wrote that 2 or 3 years ago, and it draws on experiences teaching at the many places I've taught, you know, from elites at Stanford to your average CSU student and to our students. I've had the same experience teaching world history almost everywhere. And I've had it even in my classes in the fall, where I will have one student quite recently reading about the early modern Atlantic slave trade. When they find out about the many forms of slavery in that period, they will accuse me of whitewashing slavery. That's the kind of identity politics student on the left. You're whitewashing slavery by trying to deconstruct it and analyze it. At the same time, I'll have a student with a right-wing nationalist view say very, very soon thereafter that the way I teach world history is anti-white, anti-male. So both sides of the ideological spectrum will approach this differently. From a nationalist perspective, it's the end of the world because of the changes we have. From an identity politics perspective, nationalism is the root of all troubles, but it's also quite natural.
You mentioned earlier a social justice lens.
Right.
Now, when we think about social justice studies, and you have a social justice lens where you look at these kind of critical issues in the book, but when you're looking historiographically and then you're looking at the history of the 20th century, you're literally laying out various sides of a lot of these intellectual debates and discussions in a way that you're inviting the reader, inviting the student to say, well, don't just react to this. You actually need to wrap your head around the other view and the other idea.
And the reason I teach world history and chose to focus on it is it doesn't satisfy anybody's comfortable assumptions about the past or the present. When you teach world history, it very quickly shows that the nationalist viewpoint, make America great again, the Anglo-American knight in shining armor historical narrative that we always do good. And world history shows that that's not the case. It's just not the case. You have to look at the dark underside of Anglo-American history too, and that's why I love world history, because it critiques the kind of right-wing conservative, often male perspective that there are good nations and bad nations, good people and bad people. That won't surprise most listeners. I also think world history, though, is useful in that it actually serves to make a critique of the far-left identity politics perspective, which tends to be ahistorical for a start-off. It focuses on very just causes, which I've spent my life working toward and still stand with. But it tends to have a very ahistorical viewpoint. It's kind of the reverse of the exceptionalist nationalist narrative. It's the inverse of that. It's the woe is me, oppression Olympics, my people have suffered the most. Both of those perspectives are undermined by world history. World history doesn't favor right-wing or left-wing thinking or different social groups. It shows that history is complex and messy. And at most times in history, certain groups are acting in their own self-interest, and that's not along racial or national lines.
So as someone that's been teaching history as long as you and someone that's written this textbook, how do you find ways to invite people to understand that history matters, but not just the history with which they're inclined to agree?
I think first and foremost by having people take world history classes or reading world history, of which there are many books available online and many increasing numbers of documentaries. I do believe what I said to that Stanford student 10 years ago, that teaching world history can change so much. This is not to be condescending, but I think most of us know most people, whether they're 20, 50 or 80, are walking around right now with a tiny sliver of historical information in their minds. They don't really know much other than the American narrative in this case, or in England, the English narrative. So even good-willed, intelligent, educated, well-traveled people today are walking around with a very thin understanding of what actually happened, as much as we know, not just in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, but in the past century. I grew up in England to an Irish family. I learned English history. I didn't even know about the Irish famine. I learned nothing of the Irish plight. So I grew up as an English nationalist. Then in my 20s, I start learning about the IRA and Irish history, and I become very attached to my Irish roots and the English are the roots of all evil perspective. But then once you start doing research into British or Anglo-Irish history, you realize it's way more complicated. It neither pleases the IRA nationalist or the British nationalist, the Royal Empire nationalist. Nobody's pleased by history, and that's where world history can come in with as objective a lens as we can expect.
In that sense, you're suggesting that it's an objective lens simply because it incorporates so many different perspectives, right? So you're trying to level it out.
And inherently, if you're looking at world history in a textbook, it's drawing on research. You're looking at, let's say, the Dutch and Indonesia from not just a Dutch historian's perspective or a Eurocentric perspective, but there will now be research by Indonesian descent historians looking at those sources and stories differently. So world history is based upon research from many angles inherently.
You mentioned Vietnam. Very few people seem to know that somewhere in the neighborhood of 3 million Vietnamese died during the Vietnam War.
And Cambodians under Pol Pot's regime. Why does that happen? What's the role of the United States fighting the good fight in the war spread into Cambodia? Why does this man, who's ostensibly a communist, kill over 1 million of his own people in this case? So for me, another way to look at world history is we all know the horrible stats on the Holocaust or numbers of Russians dead, etc., etc. But what does it mean when you incorporate Chinese history into our Cold War, World War II narrative, when Mao Zedong takes control and he's going to kill, 50 to 100 million people because of ideology and buffoonery? So it just broadens your perspective. It doesn't diminish the traditional narrative of World War I and II and the Cold War. If a person's a person, what does it mean that this many Chinese people died?
How do you deal with revisionists and so forth in the text?
The best way to do that is to find a consensus. There's always going to be two schools of thought, and then a third forms kind of in a dialectical, synthetical way. And it's ever-changing. But we teach students that we don't know what happened. This is the latest understanding of what might have happened in the last century. It's provisional knowledge. It's the innocence and humility of being a historian. You're not teaching the facts of the past. You're teaching what we think we know about recent events, let alone early modern events. And when I start my class in 1500, the first thing, of course, I talk about is the Atlantic slave trade. But I do say, what does it mean when we talk about this, that there are tens of millions of slaves around the world today? Students may not know that, but there are. There are websites, freetheslaves.net. And then if that doesn't interest students enough and world historicize it, I ask them, how much do you think that matters to you? What are you using today in the living room, in this room and in your house, computers and products that are connected to that slave trade? And they realize they're implicit in it today. And I think world history is a useful tool for provocative questions like that, because it's such a broad context, you can ask very provocative questions.
We're speaking with Professor John Corbally. The book we're talking about right now, The 20th Century World, 1914 to the Present. John Corbally is on the history faculty at Diablo Valley College. You can find him online. John, at the very end, you have It's the End of the World as We Know It, right, riffing on REM. Do you feel fine?
I choose to. Again, you can look at the state of the world today with different historical lenses. You can think it's the end of the world, or you can think things could be worse. And that depends upon your view of history, your understanding of history. As depressing as that 20th century is and was to write about, I actually think we are still going in the right direction. That was the point of that epilogue, is that we were polluting the planet much worse in the West in the 1980s than we are today. We have to choose to continue along that path. Things are getting better in many ways, although there's so much work to be done. And I think if you look at the 20th century and understand how things really were 100 years ago, this was not a pleasant, nostalgic world of joy and happiness. This was a world of squalor, violence, misery, and brutality.
We're speaking with Professor John Corbally. He's on the history faculty at Diablo Valley College. You can get in touch with John Corbally if you'd like through the DVC website, jcorbally@dvc.edu. We're going to wrap up this segment, but I'd be remiss if I didn't at least bring up this little tidbit. You know, in the latest brand new Project Censored movie coming out on fake news and critical media literacy, we've heard the saying that journalism is the first rough draft of history, implying that it really matters that we try to get things right the first time, and we don't. But writing a book like this, right? Ralph McGahee once said, and this is Aaron Good brought this up in our film, CIA whistleblower Ralph McGahee once said something to the effect that today's fake news is tomorrow's fake history. So just really quickly, you know, after writing a book on the 20th century, what does that phrase mean to you as you went through the 20th century and all the things that you need to unpack?
I'm not sure you and I fully agree on this, but I don't know of a period when there was a real golden age of journalism and good reporting. In what period were you getting anything but fake news? That doesn't mean we don't have major new problems today enhanced by social media and YouTube, etc. We do, and that's the war we have to fight. But again, as a historian, I'd like to know when the news was good or efficient or well-reported, aside from perhaps the BBC now and again.
Yeah, well,
and even that's dubious.
We actually agree on that, other than some of the heyday of the muckrakers, the Lincoln Steffens and Ida Tarbells and Upton Sinclairs. And there's been people. Like, and there's certainly been George Seldes, I.F. Stone. But again, they seem often to be more exceptions than rules.
That's the point, is that we look back at that and thank God they came about and influenced later history and policies in the 1930s and after World War II. But at the time, I'm sure they were sitting in rooms like this thinking nobody's listening to me. And we've got those people today, like yourself. We've got more today. And although we've got this rising tide of hate on the right, enhanced by YouTube and conspiracy theories, we've also got millions of people with technology, not just on the left, but supporting an open society and a free press. And I'm optimistic.
Yeah, well,
we have to be.
It sounds like you really are. And this is a fantastic book. I cannot recommend it more highly. And not just for educators, not just for people that are teaching these courses. This is a book that's written for the general reading public. Making of the Modern World is the series. State of Modernity is the book we were talking about today. The 20th Century World, 1914 to the Present. We were speaking with author Dr. John Corbally. And John Corbally, I'd like to have you back and a couple of your co-authors back on. Maybe we can tackle each of the other books in succession. John Corbally, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with historian Dr. John Corbally on the 20th Century World, 1914 to the Present, State of Modernity. This is the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Up next on the program, we welcome back Chase Palmieri, not as co-host, but as CEO of Kreder. We'll get an update on crowd-contested media, on keeping media accountable in an era of fake news. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. At a time when trust in news media institutions is at an all-time low, and as we head into what will surely be a contentious election year, having quality, factual information reaching the voting public is more important than ever. We've seen many efforts to address the so-called crisis of fake news, from algorithms to flat-out censorship. But today's guest believes that crowd-contested media and critical media literacy are the solutions. In today's show, we check in with our friends at Kreder.com, the news review site that hopes to restore the public's trust in media. Their crowd-contested media platform allows journalists and the general public to review news articles, creating credibility ratings for each article, author, and outlet, with the end goal being that the news competes for credibility, not clicks. Today's guest is also co-host of the Project Censored show, Chase Palmieri. Chase Palmieri is also the CEO and one of the co-founders of Credder.com. Certainly, listeners of the Project Censored show remember us talking about Credder and remember Chase talking about this site before. But there have been many updates, improvements, and a lot of news here going around to talk about regarding Credder and crowd-contested media. And so we wanted to give our listeners an update and also remind people that they can take a look at the platform and participate in it themselves at Credder.com. And so Chase Palmieri is here today to talk to us about what exactly is crowd-contested media, why does he think Credder is part of this solution, and also how you, the listener, can get involved. Chase Palmieri, welcome back to the Project Censored show to talk about Credder.
Always a pleasure.
Chase, tell our listeners the story. How did this begin? You can give us the crash course because we're mostly focusing on some of the updates that you've been working on because Credder now is no longer brand new. And of course, prior to that, it was called tribeworthy.com. You've been working on this project for several years, but in the last year, it's really been taking off. So tell us why Credder.com and what is it?
As co-host of the Project Censored show, I've always had a passion for the media and how information reaches audiences. And when we saw the dying off of newspapers and therefore journalism moving into the online realm, we knew that that meant that the way that they were going to support themselves was going to have to be with what is the main revenue model of online media, online advertising. And so what we were watching was the beginnings of this race to the bottom for clicks and attention, and a journalism that was beginning to be more and more focused on these traffic metrics, these artificial metrics of likes and shares, more than it was about the actual quality of the content itself or the quality of the reporting. I have a background in the restaurant business and been passionate user of Rotten Tomatoes my whole life. And so I've seen how these consumer review platforms can hold producers in certain industries accountable. And so my friends and I got together and we tried to first find a platform where we could actually review the news. And after about 3 weeks of searching far and wide, we couldn't find anything. And we decided, well, maybe we were the first ones to stumble on this concept, or at least the first ones with the skill sets and the time and passion to be able to put it forth into something. And so we moved into a house together here in Petaluma and started what has now become Credder, CREDDER.com. We also have a Chrome extension and an iOS app on the way, but Credder's really started to take off. It's proven itself as the only and market-leading review site for news. And the scores that we're getting for articles, authors, and outlets are coming out incredibly accurate. And we've got enough to really cover a lot of our bases, a lot of the sources producing news today.
So since we last spoke, one of the things that you've developed, there's a number of things you've developed, and I'm sure you're going to update us and tell the listeners what's new and what's coming with Credder.com, crowd-contested media. But one of the things that I know that you've been doing is you have a daily Credder, right? You have a review, a bulletin, a daily report.
The Credder Daily Newsletter.
Tell us about that.
That is just another one of our various products where we try to meet the news consumer where they already are. It's a super convenient little newsletter where we send you five of the day's biggest headlines right there in your inbox. And it's this non-committal way for our users to re-engage with us on a daily basis. If they see a headline they like, they'll read it, and then our review process is right there along with the article, and it's a way for them to stay active in Credder even if they forget every once in a while to come back to the site.
And so this is something that people can sign up for?
Yeah, it's an email newsletter which you can sign up for. You can find the link on Credder.com. And then another kind of similar product is our Chrome browser extension, which once you download once, allows you to, again, never come back to Credder.com if you don't want to. But then once you go and you get your news online, once you land on that article or that author outlet, we'll do a really quick search of our database and then populate a rating there for you, as well as other journalists and public reviews on that article, author, or outlet. And so you might as well have it. It can't hurt, a way of understanding the sources and the reputation of whoever you're reading.
So again, these are convenient ways that people can stay aware of what's going on with the news ratings. This Chrome browser, this means basically that I could tool around on the internet and say I'm reading the news stories or reading what I'm reading. And if I feel passionate about a story one way or the other, I can just click on this. I don't have to go to the website at all.
Right. You never have to come back to Credr.com again. Again, we're trying to make it easy for you and give news consumers the tool where they already are, which is going and bouncing from site to site. And so, yeah, once you land on that content, we'll pop up the rating, and then you could actually review the article when you're done reading it right there through your browser.
Let's remind listeners, how long has Credr been in existence?
Credr itself was incorporated in November of 2018 and then launched its first beta website and a couple of accompanying products in May of 2019. But before that, we were known as Tribeworthy. We've even been on this show here with you as Tribeworthy back in the day. And back then when we were Tribeworthy, meaning trustworthy as decided by our tribe of users, that was the kind of play on words there. Back when we were Tribeworthy, we were really just three kids stumbling into what we thought was a big opportunity and a big problem that needed solving. And at the time, it was just us working with people like Project Censored and you, Mickey, on what a review process for news might look like, and coming together with all these different critical media literacy professors and just throwing people at the process and saying, all right, can you leave a really helpful review on this piece of content in three clicks or less? And that was our goal.
We're speaking with Chase Palmieri, the founder of Credr.com.
The team is growing. We have a new designer as well.
Pretty small team still.
Pretty small team. Really tight-knit family, all hyper-passionate about solving this problem and not so concerned about the salary, thank God, and a little bit less on the financial rewards, but more on just the reward of bringing this to the public.
Several of you, of course, had day jobs and so forth. Right?
Yeah, the first 2 years, we didn't take a dollar out of the company. We're working full-time jobs elsewhere and working this through the night.
Another labor of love. It's something that you really felt passionate about in college and went and did something about. You've got six advisors. Just for full disclosure, listeners should know that I am one of the people on the Credr Advisory Board. But the main reason for that is how we met in Petaluma, where we both live, and it was an interesting, serendipitous meeting. But besides that, there's a natural layover between what you're trying to do with Credr and, of course, what we've been doing for a very, very long time at a nonprofit like Project Censored, and that's raise awareness, news literacy awareness, teach people critical media literacy, the tools by which to think critically about the news and the power that shapes the news and makes the news. And we do it academically, and we have a curriculum, and we do it in the classroom. And again, Credr.com is actually a very, very useful tool as a platform to bring into all kinds of different courses, political science courses, sociology courses, communications and journalism courses, any kind of critical thinking courses. I mean, it runs the gamut. And what you're trying to provide the public then, not everybody's going to college. People that go through college, they eventually graduate and they move on to other things. But that doesn't mean that we don't need to be sharp about how we get our news. Like we said at the outset, we live at a time when trust in corporate media in particular is at an all-time low. And so Credr is one of the ways in which you're trying to have these news outlets earn credibility. And so it was a natural fit for education. And so how do you, Chase, see, given that there's a lot of people listening out there that may be in education, how do you think people could use this in a classroom? Because I know you've been to many conferences with us, you've been into classrooms with us. Tell the people out there who maybe don't know, how do you see this working in a classroom, and what can you do to help a teacher or a student get this going on as part of an assignment, part of a curriculum?
What's really exciting about Credr's approach to critical media literacy is that we take what is an important theoretical and conceptual learning out of the classroom and into real life, really overlaid on top of the news that students are already reading. So what's, again, unique about Credr is that you can actually review the articles you're reading instead of just thinking about how do I pick apart this piece of information. You can do that through our review process, and we help guide you through the steps, and then you can actually leave the feedback, which is then helpful to the next reader. So as far as instructors, we don't do nearly enough to take advantage of the opportunity that is these kind of classroom workshops, and we really want to take a bigger approach to that and turn that up in 2020. But the way that teachers could use this is actually very straightforward. You can tell your students about it. You can post some articles and ask your students to review those particular articles or have them post articles and review each other's articles. But what's great is that every review is transparently there. They have to tag a specific problem that they found in the article or a specific reason that they trusted the article, and they tag that to the article. And what's great for the instructors is that they can actually look at these reviews and see how their students' reviews are improving throughout the semester, throughout the class program. And in fact, we even have what's called reviewer ratings, where the entire credit community votes on how helpful your review was, helpful or not helpful, and that creates your reviewer rating. So even following the students' reviewer ratings, or maybe even turning it into a competition where every student has to review 20 articles throughout the semester or the program, and let's see who comes out with the highest reviewer rating based on the class, and then that student gets to be rewarded. And we're really trying to make it a cool, prestigious thing to be a news critic.
Being a news critic, of course, is a very important job, especially in the kind of era we find ourselves these days, right? In the alleged post-truth world where alternative facts are used to buttress fake news. Chase Palmieri, what about high school? What about junior high? And I'm really pushing the education angle here because, again, I think that this is a really interesting tool. And I think it's actually an underutilized tool in education at this juncture because Kreder's fairly new. And even though we've talked about it a couple of times, and even though certainly a lot of professors and people in the critical media literacy world have become gradually more familiar with you and the work of Kreder, there's a lot of people out there that are trying to deal with how do we teach junior high school students how to navigate the news. And so this is one way that you're saying that could be done. So for all the teachers out there or people that think that this is an interesting idea, Kreder.com, Chase, is there a way that some of these people could contact you or maybe have an education page on the site?
Yeah, absolutely. I am happy to come speak at just about any high school or college class and hold the instructor's hand while they introduce this concept and the platform to their users. And anybody out there listening that wants to get a hold of me to do so, just email me at Chase, C-H-A-S-E, at Kreder.com. Again, Kreder is spelled with two D's, C-R-E-D-D-E-R. So Chase at Kreder.com. I'll try to get back to you right away. We can line up a time for me to come talk to your class and see how your students react to it. But I can already tell you, based on many of the classrooms I've gone and spoken to, Mickey, a lot of your classrooms I've spoken to, the students are incredibly receptive to this. They're already used to these kind of review sites and these review platforms as a way of driving their own traffic or finding quality or discovering what's best and leaving their feedback. So it's very native for your students. And the more you look into it, I think you as an instructor out there will see that this aligns perfectly with whatever your curriculum is around media literacy.
And it's also the case, I know our associate producer, Dennis Murphy, recently was able to get a video of a workshop that you were doing locally. You did a presentation with a great PowerPoint slideshow and so on, and that's going to be up online soon. So there's other ways too. This show airs on quite a number of stations, close to 50 stations around the country. If you know, just because you don't live in the San Francisco Bay Area doesn't mean you can't get online and eventually see how this stuff works.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So definitely stay tuned for that. Just a reminder, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're talking to Chase Palmieri about Kreder.com. So after the musical break, we're going to continue our conversation about crowd-contested media and Kreder.com. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are getting updates about crowd-contested media, rating news sources online as a way to create some news integrity, as it were. We're talking with Chase Palmieri of Credit.com. Of course, listeners here know Chase is sometimes co-host of the program. And so today, again, getting an update on Credit. It's been not quite a year since the formal launch, but this has been going on for a few years in a couple different iterations, as you mentioned to us earlier, Chase. But right now, we talked a little bit about education, very important. I know there's people out there saying, well, Yelp can't be trusted, or Rotten Tomatoes can't be trusted, or these systems can be gamed with bots or with angry users or with people that are just trying to target somebody and take them down. So I definitely wanted to get an update from you about all of that host of questions. It seems to me that that's one of the first things that always comes up is there's people out in the audience shaking their heads. You could just see them saying, nah, this is interesting, but how do you deal with trolls and how do you deal with people that want to game it or want to flood the platform with propaganda?
And it's rightfully the first concern that everyone should have, because it's definitely a concern that we took seriously as we were building this up from the foundation. So I would say, first of all, let's remember that right now there is zero way for any news consumer to hold media accountable or hold news producers accountable. So that is unacceptable. Whether we are the perfect iteration of how that comes to be is yet to be seen. We're the first player out there. We're the biggest. We're the market leader. But hopefully we'll be more competition in this field, because we would love to see the space grow. Second, I'll say we take a Rotten Tomatoes kind of approach more than we do a Yelp approach. But when I say we take a Rotten Tomatoes approach, it's because we have a critic category and a public category. The critic category is made up of verified journalists that we hand verify. There are requirements that you can see on the website for what qualifies you as somebody that can review in the critic category. And those are people that we have hand-confirmed are human beings. They are not bots. They are not trolls. They are real journalists reviewing the content that you're seeing. So even everything else I'm about to answer about gaming the ratings and paying for ratings or things like that, if you don't trust the public score, that's fine. That's why we have a critic category. Just go with the critic category. But the public score is about addressing the fact that if we want news consumers to really trust this solution, they need to be able to participate in it. And so that's really why the public score is there. So as far as gaming the ratings, I'll start with the confirmation bias. People are just going to positively review the news that aligns with their political leaning. Well, that's actually not what we're seeing, because those first years when we were tribe-worthy and we were toughing it out in an apartment together, what we were doing was creating this media literacy review process, which the whole purpose was to pull out your own bias and your own subjective take out of the review. It's to get you to be as objective as you can and tag a very specific reason to your review, whether that's a type of logical fallacy or a specific type of bias or a specific fact check that you'd like to do or a specific mistake you want to call out. You have to be very specific. And that is the friction of the review process, but it's also what leads to the quality reviews that we see on the site. And then once you've left that review, as I mentioned, there's the reviewer rating. So the community can vote on your review as being helpful or not helpful, which creates that reviewer rating that is then displayed next to all of your reviews. So that is a way for you, the news consumer who's checking this out to see whether an article or author or outlet is worth your time. It's a way for you to instantly know whether even the review you're reading is worth your time reading, because you can see the level of quality participant they are in the system. So, for example, somebody has a 95% reviewer rating and has left 400 reviews. That's somebody who is probably doing their best to stay within reason and not get too excited when they're leaving their reviews. Those are the main ways. We're thinking about ways that we might use the reviewer rating to weigh reviews in the future. We look at account creation very closely. We're thinking about ways that we can guarantee one person, one account. And there's ways we can do that with other kind of products that we can integrate. But right now, we're not big enough where mobs of people are trying to game the process. We're not big enough where people are trying to pay for reviews. These are things that we're looking at and we're working on. But at the moment, the reviewer community on Credit, we're amazed every day with how committed and focused they are on using the tool the right way.
So can you tell us how many users are there?
Roughly 6,000 active reviewers in any given month.
Can you talk about how many critics
critics, we've got probably about 400 critic accounts. Not all of them are active, because the thing about critics is they are writing their own content. Yeah. They're active working journalists, so their time is money. So it's a little more hit and miss on when they can get to reviewing the content, but we do have a lot of reviewers in that category as well.
So what do you see moving forward? There's been a lot of change. There's been a lot of developments. You've really built up the number of people that are there. And of course, I recall in our previous conversations, one of the things that you really were hoping for is more. The more people that are there, the more people that are using it, the more the ratings seem to mean.
That's absolutely right. It's what you might call, in Silicon Valley speak, a network effects business. With each new user and each new reviewer, the platform gets better for the other user next to them or that comes after them, because now there's more reviews, more ratings, they're more accurate, and the whole thing just keeps getting more and more useful. So it has that runaway effect.
So what do you think right now is one of the biggest challenges that you face in building this platform?
I think the biggest challenge is our revenue models, really, because what we're trying to do is bring journalism away from the ad-based revenue models. And so it doesn't make much sense for us to participate in that. So what we're trying to do actually is become the Patreon for media, allow audiences to tip one time or a monthly recurring directly to their favorite journalists and outlets. And we would take the transaction fee on that. And that model will work for us. It's just that it is one of those models that is kind of insignificant until you have a massive user base. So it's just about covering our cost of burn and making sure that there's enough investment in Creditor so that we can really get it to where it needs to be. As far as where we want to grow to or the big opportunity we see in front of us, the strategy has always been that this media landscape, we see a lot of major platforms like the Facebooks, Twitters, Googles. These platforms, a lot of them are under attack for how they're handling the news on their platforms. And they don't really want to be in the censorship game. The society really doesn't want them to be in the censorship game, but they're very clearly under pressure from Congress and regulators to do something. And so it's always been Creditor's strategy to build up the ratings for these articles, authors, and outlets enough that we can actually license Creditor ratings to these third-party platforms as a way of gaining traffic and attention to Creditor itself, but also as a way of solving these platforms' problems for them so that they can continue to focus on whatever their use case is, whatever their specific spot in the social media landscape is, but just overlay this information, these Creditor ratings, on top of the content that already exists on their sites.
That's the challenging elements, right? What are you doing in terms of, you know, addressing these kinds of challenges at running this kind of a platform in an industry that's changing very rapidly and not always positively? So let's get to that end of the spectrum with Creditor. What are the prospects, do you think, for this year? And what do you hope for, you know, on the better end of the spectrum to achieve this year, number one? And two, how do you see this working to be a solution for so many of the problems that are in the journalistic industry right now, right? Especially the flattening of local news and these types of things?
The prospects are really good. It's a good time to be a news review site, I would say, because the timing of the fake news term and the hysteria around that and people's fears over, rightfully so or not, Russian interference in social media platforms and all the problems around news today and these social sites and how important people are starting to understand that they are to our information ecosystems. It's a good time to be offering these players a way out, a solution that doesn't involve them having to necessarily focus on the problem themselves or do things like censoring content that is just going to hurt their trust in their own platform. And censoring creates many more problems than it solves. So that is all looking really good for us.
We have a couple minutes left in the segment, and I want to make sure that you get an open-ended question, because there is so much that you've worked on over the last few years on this. There's a whole technological side, right, that some of our listeners might be very interested in, and we're not going to do a whole show on the technical side, but certainly people can contact you if they have other questions, other concerns, chase@creditor.com. What else would you like listeners to know about what's going on with Credr.com that I didn't get to ask about?
I'd just like to reiterate that trust in news media is at an all-time low. Whether you look at 2 years ago, last year, or this year, regardless, the last 3 years have been an all-time low, all-time record highs of distrust in news media. And the only solution that we see that doesn't require censorship or outsourcing our critical thinking to somebody's version of an AI for news is that we empower news consumers to start to review content themselves, work together as kind of a social news gathering concept, and actually provide these helpful ratings or labels on top of the content we see. That way everything can stay up and everybody's better off for it. So that is the thesis of Credr in the first place. We believe every industry that has producers and consumers will eventually have a consumer review platform that helps the consumers know who the good actors are that are producing in that industry. And so we think the same thing applies to news. We think it's more important than ever that we solve this problem, because as our information gets worse and worse, it's going to become harder and harder for us to agree on how to solve problems like climate change, mass incarceration, or any of these other problems that are really pressing and maybe even technically more life and death than news. But I would ask everybody to remember that when you solve the information problem, all of those other problems then become easier to solve. Whereas if you solve climate change, it isn't necessarily the case that now it's easier to save journalism. So we think of this as problem number one, or the original source problem. And for that reason, I guess I would just ask that if you're somebody that is frustrated with the news you're reading, you until now have probably been somebody who reads an article, gets frustrated halfway through, and clicks the exit button. But all you've actually really done is given half of your time and half of your advertising revenue to that producer. So we would ask that you either download the extension. If you're an iPhone user, go to credr.app.link to get our open beta, or just use credr.com as the news aggregator that it is and start to actually be part of the solution and start to hold media accountable.
Chase Palmieri, Credr.com, thanks so much for the update on what's happening, and certainly wish you all the best this year. We're certainly going to need all the help we can get sorting out fact from fiction, as we're in a pretty contentious election year through the primaries, through summer, and then, of course, the presidential showdown coming in November. So Chase Palmieri, once again, thanks for joining the show, and we'll be getting another update later in the year on Credr.com.
Looking forward. Thanks, Mickey.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why
you've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips and I founded this program back in 2010. We're on close to 50 stations around the United States now. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time. Build the capacity, citizens. In the times when the master thief can find and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Times running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.